This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
New York had money. New York has always had money. New York is about making money. It's what the Dutch created the place for. And there were Indian tribes, the Eastern Woodlands Indians, who did their trading in a place that we now know is where Wall Street is today.
That's novelist Beverly Swerling talking about her latest book about old New York, City of God. The day before this show was produced, a U.S. Airways jet crash-landed in the Hudson River near Midtown Manhattan. Luckily and miraculously, all survived. Some of the survivors were taken out of the frigid waters and brought to St. Vincent's Hospital. Probably none of them knew, as do few New Yorkers, that St. Vincent's was founded by Sister Mary Seton in the early decades of the 19th century. Seton braved religious intolerance and bigotry against the poor to create an institution that still serves thousands. She's one of the characters who appears in my guest Beverly Swerling's newest novel, the latest in a series about old New York dating from its founding as a Dutch colony. They are City of Dreams, City of Glory, and now her latest, City of God. It takes place in the 1830s, a time when New York was experiencing explosive growth. Immigrants were flooding in, from China as part of New York's burgeoning trade with that country, the Irish fleeing poverty, only to find it here, and Jews from Germany swelled the tiny population of Portuguese Jews who had been in New York since it belonged to the Dutch. The ranks of the poor grew as the rich got richer, heightening class tensions. New York was pro-slavery, but it was also seething with abolitionist fervor promoted by the growing evangelical movement. But while the evangelicals condemned slavery, they promoted religious bigotry against Catholics and Jews, and they condemned the poor as being at fault for their own condition. Beverly Swerling throws the reader into this cauldron of social change while telling a gripping story of love and betrayal following two families, the Turners and the DeVrays. Beverly Swerling, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, I loved this book, City of God, and I did not know of your previous books. Now I'm going to have to go and read the other two that are in the series.
Hooray!
You had City of Dreams, which is, I guess, the first one. Is that right?
Yes, City of Dreams was the first book of the series, and it shipped, actually, on September, publishers start shipping books, as I'm sure you know. Perhaps your listeners might not be as familiar, but publishers start shipping books before the official pub date, and I think that had an October something official pub date. But City of Dreams actually started shipping on September 15th, 2001. That was 4 days, of course, after 9/11.
Wow.
And at the time, we were living in, which is how I came to write this whole series. We had been living in New York off and on for many years. My husband's a native New Yorker, and I had always been fascinated with the early history of the city. And we were living at the time that we were shipping. We were not a mile from Ground Zero, and so it was extraordinary to be writing about the city's past when all of that was happening. And then, of course, it was not a good time in some ways for a book about New York to come out, for a book about the history of New York to come out, because the terrorism issue, which was so new to us all in our innocence, of course sucked all the oxygen out of everything else. But it was certainly an interesting time for people who were interested in the history to see how devastated the city had been previously and to know that, you know, we would come back, and indeed we did.
And when you say devastated, that actually pertains, does it not, to the current, to the third one in the sequel, and that
exactly.
Is the great fire.
I had known nothing about that till I started researching it, Francesca. It was extraordinary to me to discover that whole thing and to realize that while I thought myself reasonably knowledgeable about history in general and about New York City's history by then, because I had been so deep into it now for what is, this is, as you say, the third book. Although I hasten to say that it can be read on its own, but it was extraordinary to me to discover what an amazing thing that fire of 1835 was.
Yeah, now we should tell our listeners that the first book, City of Dreams, is about New Amsterdam, that is the Dutch colony in New York. The second one, which is City of Glory, takes place during the Revolutionary War. And now moving on to, as you said, 1835. First of all, what attracts you so much to this early history of New York?
Well, a couple of things, one of which is simply that at one point in the, I think it was in the 80s, we had a place in Soho. For your listeners who don't know New York, that's sort of downtown. And right near us, somebody had taken a group, actually, a community-minded group, had taken an open, one of those old parking lot kind of places that you think, you know, is going to be full of trash all the time, and while the developers argue about how many billions of dollars they're going to sell it for. And they made a garden. But what they did was they made a garden that was meant to simulate New York before the first Europeans arrived. So they were simulating the world of the Native Americans just before contact. And it fascinated me. I spent a lot of time looking at it, and I thought, boy, you know, this would be an interesting book. And a couple of years later, I happened to be sitting with my literary agent in a little coffee shop, which was across the street from Bellevue Hospital, which is a phalanx of wonderful old Victorian, now they're Victorian buildings, although they have been rebuilt many times. The latest were built in Victorian times. And it is, of course, the great public hospital that was at one time the snake pit of the Olivia de Havilland movie, and it has a very colored, checkered history. And my agent, Henry, said to me, you know, I'd love a book about the history of Bellevue Hospital. And I thought, not a bad idea. And I began researching it, and it pushed me further and further back until I was in 1660 in New Amsterdam, further yet downtown on what is now Coenties Slip, and reading about how the first hospital in the city was set up in a workshop above a, I can't remember now, it was some sort of a chandler's, you know, the people who did things to equip the sailing boats, shop. And they took this and they put some of the wounded sailors up there. And that is the first hospital in the country. So that I realized that really the story of Bellevue began long before I had thought to begin it. And from that I began with as you say, 1660. And I actually took that book through to the end of the Revolution and then did City of Glory about the War of 1812, and now City of God about the period between 1834 and the run-up to the American Civil War.
And you know what's so fascinating about all that? Tell us about a little bit about Bellevue. You open the novel, you do a little foreshadowing, you open the novel with a Dr. Nicholas Turner. Now, this is years after the main action of the novel takes place. This is in the Civil War. But he has a very particular relationship to Bellevue. Talk about the hospital and tell us about him.
Well, a great deal because of the history of the stories, how I came to write them. As you can see, there's a lot of medical history in these books and in all of them. And in City of God, we have Nick Turner, who is the hero of the story. And he is the man who is the descendant of the early barber surgeon who comes, Lucas Turner, who in City of Dreams comes from England, actually via Holland. He comes to New Amsterdam. And at the point at which they are, you know, putting the knife in their pocket after they cut off something and then taking it back out to do something else. I mean, the entire idea of anything to do with antisepsis is, you know, it's just foreign to them. Although there were people already talking about the fact that they saw, there were microscopes, and there were people saying they saw things in these microscopes, little crawling worms, they called them. A famous New Englander by the name of Cotton Mather was among the people who saw these little worms.
Well, let me ask you then, was it in fact at Bellevue? I mean, is Nicholas Turner a stand-in for a historical doctor who did start using, you know, insisting
No.
that people wash their hands?
Nicholas Turner does in the story. He's talking about people washing their hands, and there were people all over Europe screaming about, you've got to wash your hands, and other people saying, people being medical personnel, saying, you know, how ridiculous. And so that idea was percolating in the medical community at the time, and that it was perfectly legitimate for me to pick that up for my fictional character. But it was also true that it would be three years before someone had tried an operation, and it would happen at Mass General Hospital in reality, with anesthesia. And I preempt that for Nick Turner by about 3 years. just because it suited my story to do so.
And using, was that chloroform?
No, chloroform is a derivative. He was using ether, which is what they first used. Mm-hmm. And then they found that the derivative of chloroform worked the same way. But nobody was actually looking for, I should say few people, few doctors, were actually looking for anesthetic, because there was a whole part of the religious culture of the time which said doing operations under anesthesia is contrary to the law of God.
And this is so fascinating. I mean, you call your book, Beverly Swirling, you call your book City of God. This is one of the stories that you follow, or themes that you follow in the book, is the tremendous struggles around religion and religious tolerance and intolerance. Say a little bit more about this perspective, about the evangelicals who were also quite progressive in some ways. We would
Indeed.
See them as progressive, but in other ways so terribly intolerant.
Well, that was when I first started writing this book, this particular book, I knew the period I wanted to deal with, and I had the characters. Books always begin for me with the characters. But I wasn't at all sure what I was going to call it, and that theme didn't come out until I was about a third of the way through, and I realized that what I was doing was writing about the explosion of religious opinion in New York City. The evangelicals, as you say, had just come. They started on the frontier at the time in places like Tennessee and Ohio, and they were moving east with these new ideas of religion, a kind of religion that fit right into the American dream. It was a religion that said, we don't need anybody to be interceding for us. We don't need a priesthood any more than we needed a king. We need a free religion. And it was that freedom which was made the evangelical concept so attractive. And there were revival meetings on Broadway, which blew my mind. And at the same time, you had a huge wealth of new Irish immigrants coming in, and they, of course, brought with them their Roman Catholicism, often a very primitive, ill-understood form of Roman Catholicism, and they were joined by a great influx of Jews who came from Central Europe and swelled up. But in both cases, they were swelling very small previous communities of Jews and of Catholics in New York. So now you have these three forces who are intermingling with each other, and they are contributing to the great growth of the city and to the great growth of the country. They were making us what we became, this wonderful, incredible, polyglot, multicultural thing that we are, the American unusualness, if you will, this idea that we as a nation are very different. We are a nation founded, of course, on an idea. And that idea, everything in New York is writ larger than life, because they built the city on an island. They had nowhere to go but up. That's why the skyscrapers came. And in the next book, which I'll do in the series, by the way, I'll talk about how once they discovered that they could break an elevator. They had the idea of the elevator, but they didn't know how to make brakes for it. Once they got the brakes, then the sky was the limit, and that was how we got into the Gilded Age. But in New York, that intermingling of these three major religious forces that have so far shaped much of our country was there in spades.
Three religious forces being evangelicalism, but you wouldn't put Judaism in there, would you?
Well, I was saying Protestantism, Judaism. What I meant was Protestantism, Judaism, and Catholicism. There were, at that point, at the end of the period, there were 150,000 Jews in New York City.
You say at that time there were two Jewish communities, an older one that was Sephardic and a newer one that came from Eastern Europe. Talk a little bit about that and the relationships between them.
That was a very interesting period for me to research as well, because it goes back to the original parts of the series. Peter Stuyvesant, at the behest of the Dutch West India Company, Stuyvesant himself was a bit of an anti-Semite, to say the least, but he allowed in a group of Jews from, I believe they came in from Brazil, and they were allowed to have a synagogue on Mill Street, which is today's Stone Street. And they kept to themselves. They became very much part of the city. They did well. They were, of course, wonderful traders, which has always been the great strength of the Jewish diaspora, was that they had these links in different parts of the world, and so they were able to make family links in many cases, and they were able to make business. And it was because they were good at making business that they were tolerated by people who did not tolerate them for their religious positions. But they were Sephardim, and they followed the Sephardic prayer book. Now, in the period of City of God, when we had this, and we had maybe 150, 200 people we're talking about, and all of a sudden those 150 or 200 people become 150,000, and this happened over two decades.
You also cover some of the other great issues of the day, and I have to say that the book really had tremendous resonance to our own time. And the issue of immigration, I mean, it's not just the Jews, but you have a really central character here in Mei Hua, a Chinese immigrant.
Yes.
Talk about her story and talk about the history, how that is a stand-in for the Chinese in New York.
Well, what interests me about that, and it's something I like to, you know, I'm writing about in other contexts as well, is that every immigrant story is basically the same, with the exception of American blacks who were brought here under the most appalling circumstances. And as you know, I do deal with, and particularly more in the first two books, I deal with the whole slavery issue, because it's impossible to talk about the history of this country and not face head-on the slavery issue. But for the rest of the immigrants, they come here looking for something better than what they had. And Mei Hua is, in a sense, she is a combination of both. She is brought here by Samuel Devery. The series are about the two families, the Turners and the Deverys. They are the constant throughout the books. And Mei Hua is brought here by Samuel Devery as a young woman, his bride. And he has, in effect, bought her for two cases of opium when she is a very young girl. And he loves her, and she loves him. But, of course, he keeps her in an apartment downtown on Cherry Street and lives an uptown life on Fifth Avenue, which is just then beginning to be the kind of place it will become, with a beautiful blonde white wife called Carolina, who is also one of the great heroines of the story. And neither Mei Hua or Carolina are, of course, the villains in the piece. They are both victimized by Samuel and his appetites and his strange idea about what constitutes moral behavior. And Samuel is the villain of the piece and the villain of the book. And every good book needs a villain.
And he's a great villain, too.
Oh, thank you. But Mei Hua represents the immigrant experience and the female experience, which is the other thing we haven't talked about, Francesca, which is that women were pawns in this. They were chattel, they were pawns in this period, and yet they could be very bright. And many of them, like Carolina, were quite content that what she had always wanted was to be a wife and a mother. And when she discovered that she had been lied to and victimized, she took the bull by the horns and made a life for herself and her kids. And she did it in a way that was perhaps very much out of keeping with what her society looked at as being acceptable behavior. But she did it with great courage, and these women did exist. There were women who were in business, and there were a few, were called she merchants. And when I came across that, I thought, I have a justification for allowing Carolina to do the things she does.
And she was not just a she merchant, but a sea merchant.
Yes, she was. And of course, everything. This is also the period of the great clipper ships, and those wonderful, wonderful sailing, magnificent things that put up acres of sail and could beat anything on the water. Of course, they eventually they had a very short life, something like 20 years, that they ruled the China trade, but during that 20 years, they were incredibly beautiful things. If you've ever seen the tall ships come into New York, it is something to see. And that's the era they represent.
And were they actually did they originate in New York?
Yes, they did. And they originated in New York. They were built in New York shipyards, and they brought the city out of yet another of her financial downturns back to enormous profitability.
And they were incredibly swift. Talk about the China trade and how important was it?
Well, it was extremely important because there was a great taste. New York had money. New York has always had money. New York is about making money. It's what the Dutch created the place for. The other cities of the New World were created for an idea. Boston and Providence and Philadelphia, they were all cities based on somebody's idea of how to make a perfect society. New York was created to make money. And I'll hark back another moment and tell you that there were Indian tribes in the Eastern Woodlands Indians who did their trading in a place that we now know is where Wall Street is today.
Oh, my God.
So that comes out in City of Dreams. So in City of God, of course, we're dealing with a mature China trade. And the things that they wanted from China were tea, that was prime, and porcelain and silk. And there was an endless appetite for these wonderful things. And they were sold at auction houses. The ship would come in, be unloaded. The cargo would be sold at auction houses on Pearl Street. And they would make and break fortunes for the owners of the ships and the captain and even to an extent the crew, who all got bonuses. And so the speed with which you could get back with, say, a cargo of tea or more china or more of anything else, the tea was critical because it was the drink of the time. And it also mattered how long it was on board, you know, how fresh you got it mattered. So the speed of the clipper ships was just incredible.
We're talking with Beverly Swerling about her latest in her trilogy, although it might actually become, I don't know what you call something that has four books.
There is a fourth book in the series that I've contracted to do with Simon and Schuster. We are doing another book.
Wonderful. And it is a series of books about the history of New York. Wonderful novels. We're talking about City of God. Previous ones were City of Dreams and City of Glory.